Aloha, mud babies, pod people, and inhabitants of the planet Earth. It is I, your tiki leader, Steve Mudflap McGrew. And again, another podcast from the hotel room at the MGM Grand, where I'm working Brad Garrett's Comedy Club with this lovely, lovely man. You guys don't know, he not only is he a brilliant comedian, but he is an underwear model as well. And yeah, please welcome.
This is what you want to see. Unsheathed.
Please welcome Sam Fedeli. Sam, how's it going?
Great to be here, my friend. Great to be here.
Thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a blast. I listen to it a lot. I'm glad to be on it.
Well, you've actually seen a couple of these, right?
Mm-hmm.
You saw the end of another one of these.
And, indeed. That's why I watched the end of the last one you just did.
That's brilliant. Brilliant. And
2100.
Now, let's start this way on the podcast. Is this your favorite club in the world?
Lord. Hands down. Gotta be. I mean, we're treated like kings. You know that.
Brad Garrett's Comedy Club.
Nobody treats you like Brad does. And and there are other clubs out there that are wonderful, and we both work them and enjoy them. And those people are great, too. But this is just notch above. Yeah. I think it's because of him, obviously.
Yeah. I think I told you this the other night. I think it's because Brad was a comic before he got famous.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knows what it's like to be a comic on the road and goes, I want them to be treated better than I was out on the road.
He actually told me one time that he was treated so respectfully and so wonderfully by Rodney Dangerfield when he did Rodney's clubs. He always wanted to emulate that. He wanted to make a club where comics could go to feel safe, where this is your place. This is your home. Come in.
This is our safe space.
And it is. It's our safe space.
It's our safe space. Oh, my God.
Brad's made a safe space. But it's just wonderful. And talking to other comics as you do and I do, it's just... Everybody wants to come here. It's the hardest club in the country to get into.
Yeah.
And it's once you're in, though, it's wonderful.
But there are so many good clubs around the nation. Mm. I don't want one club owner to hear this and go, so they're giving me the... No.
No, like we said earlier, they're all good.
I love all you guys.
This one's just different.
Yeah. So let me ask, let's go do a little history for people that don't know. What got you started in comedy? How old were you when you said, this is what I want to do?
I was always kind of funny. I know it sounds egotistical, but I was a class clown in high school. I had no aspirations to be a comedian. I wanted to be the next Elvis Presley.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah, but I can't sing, so that was really funny. But I had, what, like 417 gold records? I know the words every one of them, something like that. But, I joined the service and got in trouble making fun of my drill instructors, imitating them. So comedy's always kind of been there in the background for me. And finally, I was going to go to school. I was in my late 20s. And I said, you know, I owned a blueprint company in Newport Beach, and something wasn't right. So I said, I'm going to be a lawyer. So I saw a comedy class at a college, and I go, wow, if I could learn how to make people laugh, I could certainly sway a jury.
Yeah.
So I went to the comedy class, and I came out first. And then I went to the advanced class, and came out first. And I went, I'm not going to school. Screw that.
This I don't want to be a lawyer.
I don't want to be a lawyer. Wear a suit.
I want to be a dentist.
I want to sleep till 1 in the afternoon. So that's the evolution there. And I just started from there. And
You told me a great story the other night about how wanting to be a singer. Can you tell that story on here about that band when you were a kid?
Oh, my God. I have a very talented, talented friend of mine who I went to school with since I was 10 years old. You can look him up. His name is Steve Conte, C-O-N-T-E. He used to be the lead guitarist for the New York Dolls, and he is currently he's the lead guitarist for Marilyn Monroe. Anyway, he's got a talented family. His brother, John, is the bassist for Southside Johnny and the Jukes. And their mom, Rosemary, is a wonderful singer and has been for years. Anyway, it's a beautiful family.
Very talented family.
Very talented, beautiful, artsy family. And they're all successful. And I wanted to be in a group with... I wanted to be Elvis. I wanted to be the next Elvis. So 10 or 12 years old, I don't remember exactly what it was, but Steve and his brother are starting a band, and I'm in. So I show up at their house, and they go, well, where's your instrument? And I go, here's my instrument. I'm pointing at my throat. I sing. I'm a singer. I don't need an instrument.
This is my instrument. I am the instrument.
Everything I need is right here. And we practiced for 1 or 2 days, and because they were good friends of mine and they're so sweethearts, they didn't have the heart to tell me I was god-awful.
Oh.
So their mom, Rosemary, sat me down and said, Sam, you're a wonderful young man, and we love having you around, but I don't think the band's going to work out for you.
Here's a tambourine.
Here's a tambourine, yeah. I couldn't even do that. I have no timing whatsoever. So they went on to their huge success, all of them, and we stayed friends and everything, and it's just been fun since. But I got a rude awakening as a young man.
Was that the point you thought, okay, that's not going to be the road then?
No, heck no. I thought, well, she's wrong.
She is wrong.
I can sing. You're not crushing my dream. Not that she was attempting to, but she was 100% correct.
Speaking of Elvis, I saw this morning somebody had posted the American Trilogy. I saw it on Facebook today. The American Trilogy with the whole that jumpsuit band. Oh. Remember that one clip?
Was it the one from Hawaii?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Nothing better.
Yeah, and I actually got goosebumps laying in bed watching it on my iPhone. Glory!
He hits
the band
notes.
Is like.
It's thunderous. It's amazing.
It's thunderous. I'm getting goosebumps just talking about it.
I love Elvis number one. He's always been my favorite, and. To hear him sing that and the patriotic feel to it and everything, it's just, I love it.
You know, and I don't want to really be disrespectful to Elvis, which I have been in the past.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Not today.
Not today. Not today, my friend. But as I was watching that video, let me take you back just a little. As you're watching the video and you see him in the jumpsuit, the collar, the rhinestone, and the karate, do you ever think it crossed his mind? What the hell am I doing?
Yeah, I would imagine I imagine anybody who reaches a pinnacle that high sometimes lay in bed going, man, somebody pinch me. This can't be real. And I think he probably plays with it, too. He probably goes, let me try this. What the heck, everything else works with the karate and all the other stuff. So, yeah I think people get to that pinnacle and they say to themselves, wow.
Because nobody had ever done that before. Nobody ever had put on that outfit. I mean, people parodied that outfit after that.
And they still do today.
They still do.
Look where we are in Vegas. There's every other hotel's got an Elvis impersonator.
Right. But I'm saying even at that time period, people like Donnie and Marie on the show, they had their jumpsuits and they all like...
I remember fringe belts
fringe
and everything.
Belts.
Yeah. had everything.
But he kind of said, I'm doing this. Ah, I'm adjusting my big wrestler belt. Oh,
here we go.
Yeah.
So, strap in, baby.
So do you have anything that you think one day might become your signature thing? Is there the Sam, you know?
I'll probably be eating a cheeseburger on stage. I don't think that's been done. I don't have anything. I don't have those kind of aspirations. I don't think there's anything specific to me. But if I ever get that famous, I'm going to figure something out. Trust me.
Start thinking of things.
I'm just going to start doing weird stuff.
Because sometimes don't you think you need a hook that takes you up and over and... Because Elvis was a great singer.
Oh, yeah.
But all of a sudden you'd say, like, that Elvis was iconic.
Oh, yeah. But he was already gigantic by the time he started wearing them goofy suits. I mean, that started in the 70s. In 69, he was in that leather suit doing his cool as you can look. His comeback thing. So
Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, exactly. I saw, Raw with
Raw,
the red leather
red,
suit?
Red leather suit.
There's no Gumby today, whatever he said.
Now, do you feel like certain clothes affect your performance affect your performance?
100% for me. New Year's Eve, I tried to wear a tie. I was actually here a couple of years ago at Brad's. And I wanted to be respectful to the audience and to Brad and everybody. So I dressed up in a nice suit, big tie. And I run around a lot and I'm sweaty all the time. So, it was awful. I was awful for the first 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And actually, Paul, who runs the place here, said to me afterwards, he said, you were really in your head up there. Something wasn't wrong. He said, we actually considered giving you the light early. He goes, but then I pulled the tie off and I went, just screw this. And
what I do.
Exactly. And then I just got back into my regular routine and was able, lucky enough, to get the audience back on my side. But yeah, I agree 100% that clothes definitely affect you. It's a cool look. You yourself have a tremendous look when you go up there with that shirt right there and the shoes and the jeans and the hair and the whole thing. It's a whole persona that people go, wow, this is going
to
be different.
Well, thank you. And it's something that I had to kind of get across to some of the cruise ships. We both work cruises. And they have the, you should wear a jacket. We like our guys in a European suit. And I'm like, no, it's not what I do. I can't imagine with the way I look coming out of the suit and trying to pull off.
It wouldn't work.
It wouldn't work.
No. just keep wearing what you wear and get your standing ovations. Let the guys in the European suits go back to their room crying about how, well, I dress so nice. Why didn't they laugh?
Why didn't they like me? Why didn't they?
Keep up what you're doing.
Yeah,
well, you've gone through a couple of different looks, though. I remember you had an Elvis stage with the pompadour and the black, and it was awesome, man.
Well,
that's when I knew you. That's when I first found you.
Kristen, the comic we're working with this week, she said you guys actually were in the back room Googling old pictures.
Well, I told Brad and Kristen, we were talking about Dolly.
Yeah.
And all the wonderful things she's doing for those fire victims right now. And
incredible.
Somehow, I don't know, Brad said, I think it was Brad, or maybe it was Kristen, said that you opened for her or something. And I'd already known that from you, but I said, oh, yeah, it must have been his pompadour days. And Brad goes, what? I said, oh, dude, he used to look like Elvis. He had the pompadour going. And I said, I met him when he was doing, I knew him when he did the fair with your buddy, Brad and Kevin Nealon are friends. I said, well, you did the thing with Kevin. And he goes, what are you talking about? I said, yeah, it was jet black and he looked awesome. And they go, no way. So she started pulling the stuff up, and there was a picture of you standing next to Dolly and with that look. And Brad goes, oh, my God, that really did have a pompadour. Now you're the exact opposite.
Yeah. Yeah. So have you changed your look to the
I fluctuate with weight. That's how I change my look. Today I'm 5 pounds overweight. Tomorrow I'll be 10 pounds overweight. I just stay in that range right there. Nah.
That's that pizza. That was a salty-ass pizza we had last night. Thank you, Brad, for making us eat $20 pizza.
It was good, though, you got to admit.
It was good.
It was good.
$20 a slice. No. No, it wasn't really.
It was expensive, but it was tasty. I enjoyed it. But and it's fun eating with him there, sitting there losing money.
I've never seen somebody gamble like that before. Not that that's a bad thing.
So I'm not gambling.
He gambles like I gamble with a $5 bill, but like, boom, boom.
Yeah. It's a bug. I have it. I can't say anything. I gamble all the time. So whenever I come to Vegas, I'm a gambler. I work Indian casinos occasionally. I'll gamble there. So I like to gamble, and he likes to gamble. And it's just something you either like or you don't like. You can't worry about losing because you're going to lose.
What's your game of choice?
I like video poker. I also play poker with people, but I enjoy getting after a show. You know, we got all the people around us and everything. And it's so much fun, and we're appreciative of that. But I like to decompress, go by myself, just sit at a poker machine and start playing. And that's just how I come down.
Yeah. Do you watch poker on TV? Are you one of those guys?
I do on the ships.
Do you?
Yeah, because there's three channels.
True.
It's either that or a Matlock rerun. So yeah, I do.
We watched girlfriend and I watched. In Hawaii, I don't remember the name of it, but they were in the millions in the pots. Have you ever seen that?
Oh, sure.
The pot was $24 million.
I see that all the time.
And I'm like,
it's amazing.
How do people not just snap or just scream or punch a table or flip it? You know, they'll fold on a $12 million pot.
Oh, sure.
You just walked away from 12. You pushed $12 million out there and said no.
Well, you got to realize when those guys lose a $24 million pot, they're still walking away with $5, $10, $15 million as a second place player. But
what does it take to get into those kind of
money?
Is that what it is?
I'm not sure. Someone quote me on this. I believe the buy-in for the World Series of Poker is $10,000. You have to pay $10,000 up front with the opportunity to win millions at the end. I believe it's $10,000. It could have gone up now, but I've never been in that.
Yeah,
but a lot of celebrities have. Brad's
done it.
My doctor actually did it. My doctor's won the bracelet once. But it's fun. I like to watch those tournaments, and then I watch, because they show you the hands.
Yeah.
So I watch all the hands, and I say, I would do this, and I would do that. And then I watch that they do the exact opposite, and they win. I go, oh. There's a good reason I'm on this couch, and they're over there.
Yeah. Now, do you agree with all the disguises of gambling, of the glasses and the hats, and to hide the tails? Do you think it should be just straight, you should better be good at this?
Well, they're all good.
I mean, they are good.
You don't get to that point without being great.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying. You better learn not to.
Everyone has a shtick. There's the guys with the hats and the glasses, and the guys with the hoodies. And the guy with the earplugs. I don't mind them. I don't like the guys. There's one in particular. I forget his name. He's a smartass. He's always trying to get in your head. He's like, well, I won the last one. Let's see how you do on this one. Oh, you're gonna hit that? You can't have anything. You got a pair of kings. It's obvious. So and you're going to hit that?
So he trash talked.
Oh, he does it all the time, and he's so annoying.
The two guys that we watched that night with the millions, they did not say a word. Not one word was said between them until the very, very end, and they stood up and shook hands. But, I mean, I watched probably 10 or 15 hands of millions of dollars, and they just sat like this. And one guy just does the chips.
That can be annoying, too. If you're trying to make... Would you make him stop?
Stop that!
It's fun, now, though. I like it.
Would you become a professional gambler if you weren't a comic?
I don't have the money for it. To be a professional gambler, you gotta be... To be good at it, I would imagine, you got to be a millionaire. Because you're going to lose more than you're going to win. And that's the difference between a professional and a guy like me. I'll go out there and I'll play and I'll be up $300. And I'll be like, yeah, this is my night. I'm up $300. And
I saw that last night.
45 minutes later, I'm down to zero or I'm down 300. A professional gambler will get up. He sets I would imagine they set a number, an arbitrary number, be it 300, 500, 1,000. And if they reach that number, they walk away. Because you know the things aren't staying hot.
Yeah.
And most professional gamblers, I would imagine, are poker players. I don't think there's a whole ton of professional video poker players out there that do it for a living. A lot of people, millions of people play online and they make a good living at it.
Yeah. My dad used to play online poker.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And didn't they start shutting that down, though? Didn't they start doing a...
Well, it's in it. Something happened to your camera.
Okay.
But I think in America, they may have. I'm not sure. But there's so many offshore poker places that most of the companies are offshore, I would imagine, in a different area of the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Also under different rules.
Exactly.
What do you think you would be if it wasn't for stand-up? What career would you go?
A singer. I had careers. I was in the
service. Wait, now that you brought this up, I need your best Elvis impersonation right now.
Oh.
Come on. What's your...
Hey, baby. give me a song.
Hound Dog.
I don't like that one. It's Christmas time. How about this? I'll have a blue Christmas without you. You see why I don't do it?
No.
It's awful.
That was brilliant.
That was awful. And you who hang around but singers knows
that
was awful.
Screw that lady that said you couldn't do it. That is your instrument.
Somewhere Rosemary Conti's going, stop, Sam, stop. I've already tried to help you once. I love the man, though. So I don't like hearing that you make fun of him.
Oh, that's okay. I was kicked out of Graceland several times.
Seriously?
Yeah.
What did you do?
One time I got kicked out of Graceland. You know how the jumpsuits, have you been there?
Once.
Okay, the jumpsuits are all in a line, and I went, shouldn't these be getting progressively bigger with each year? Sir, if you can't be respectful, you're going to have to leave.
Yes.
Yeah, I got
I'm
that.
I'm on his side. You have to go, Steve McGrew.
Yeah. And then another time, you take the tour. As you exit out the house, you go through the gym. There's a little back gym. And the lady goes, Elvis was playing racquetball the afternoon he died. I go, that fat bastard couldn't play pinball the day he died.
So
I shouted it out at the group.
Oh, did that get a huge laugh?
Yeah. And one of those. Sir, can't be respectful. And then I was with another comic, and we were there, and he laid a bouquet of McDonald's French fries.
Oh.
Big giant thing on the grave outside, and they were like...
That's wrong.
We were asked to...
I would have asked you to leave, too. I'm sorry.
But he laid him crying. It's like you...
You're talking about my idol now. Come on. I don't want to hear this.
So wrong. I know it's so
And you're wrong.
Wrong
because the suits didn't get progressively bigger. He did. The suits just got progressively tighter.
Tighter and tighter.
Until the end, it looked bad. That last concert, especially him playing the piano, sweating, he didn't look healthy.
Don't you want somebody in your life to tell you, no, stop, slap it out of my hand, whatever?
I would really like to have friends or family that would say, hey, you're starting to look like you need to pull a ripcord on a raft there. Slow down, fatty. But I don't suppose he had a lot of those around him. They say now that they did, all the Memphis Mafia that hung out with him, they say they've made all these things and they tried so hard. And I don't think they
did. I don't believe that.
I think maybe his wife Priscilla did, but I think he tuned her out. And I have no knowledge. I'm not in that circle, but I don't believe that his friends did like they say they did. Now they're all writing books and everything. I think they just were happy to be on the gravy train. They're all getting cars every year and big paychecks mm-hmm. to hang out and go with Elvis Presley.
Elvis was the original Oprah. You get a car. You get a car. You get a car.
And he gave them to everybody. He was good. He was a giving man. He didn't have a ton of money when he's worth a heck of a lot more money now than he was when he died.
True. Well, you know, you go to Graceland and they go, you know, what a mansion that was, and it cost like $500,000 at the time. And you're like, $500,000? Yeah. That's not even a bungalow in California now.
Not even close. So, but it's a bygone era. I miss it.
I miss that about Vegas. I miss the Vegas days of dressing up and the suits and the Dean Martin and the
whole Rat Pack scene.
The whole Rat Pack scene.
I would love to have been a part of that.
Wouldn't you?
Oh, anybody who knows a Rat Pack knows this, but like they would do a show. And you could never do this now. They would do a show, and they would walk through the casino, and Dean Martin would just take over a blackjack table. He'd go behind the counter, push the blackjack dealer away, and he'd flip over a seven, a king, and a queen, and go, oh, 21, and just pay the person, no matter what the hands were. And and the hotel loved it because word of mouth got out, oh, my God, Dean Martin's dealing blackjack at the Riviera. Let's go have some fun.
Yeah.
And the next night, there's 10,000 people there that weren't there the day before. It's so corporate and so structured now, they wouldn't allow someone to do that.
Yeah.
You couldn't see like Garth Brooks walking through and start dealing poker because I don't think they would allow it.
Yeah. Now, I remember right after the city started to go corporate in the 90s, that one of the casino people that was still connected –
one of my people?
Yeah, one of your people. Said,
Italian with the crooked nose.
Said, this kind of gang stuff would not be happening if we were still running the town.
I believe it.
Remember, because there was a period where they were having the gang trouble mm-hmm. here. And
then they went through the phase of families, where they had all kids going through the casino and everything. Yeah.
Who thought that was a good idea?
Oh, man.
Who at any point said, we should make Sin City a family destination?
Exactly. Who doesn't want to gamble with their kids?
Yeah.
Nah.
And the reason that failed, I heard from several people, where the reasons were, you brought your kids, so you couldn't go out at night.
Oh.
So, you know what I mean? You weren't going to the shows because you had your kid. You weren't gambling as much as you were because you had your kid. They weren't allowed on the floor. And so what was the point of it anyway? I don't think they even thought it out.
I'm with you. It wasn't thought out. There was no long planning there.
Somebody just said, hey, we should make this more like a Disneyland with gambling.
Didn't work. The kid's going to go to Circus maybe for a half an hour and then be like, okay, what do we do now?
I'm tired.
This is boring. I heard that young people today don't gamble as much as older people. What they do here is they go to Hakkasan and all those places, and the lines are around the block of these dance clubs for people to get into, but they're not spending nearly as much money gambling. Yeah. As they are
they're
dancing.
They're more into the shows and the DJs and the pool
Lucky
parties.
For us.
I know.
We've been having great crowds.
Crowds have been great. Now, let's get back to comedy for a second. What do you remember your very first joke? Do you remember the first one that you said, this is my boom, this kills every time I'm on stage?
I did a joke about my dad. He's a grumpy old East Coast Italian, and if you could picture a cross between Robert De Niro and Danny DeVito physically, and that's what my dad looks like, and he's just a grumpy guy, and I did a whole bit about him on the plane where they ran out of peanuts just before he got to him, and he made a big deal about it. It was I don't remember the joke. I just remember that got a lot of laughs, and I milked it for as many years as I could.
Yeah.
That was my first real one.
Yeah. Now, what did he see the joke and like the joke?
He's a huge Rat Pack, Dean Martin, Frank. He's an East Coast Italian, whatever. So I remember the first time he really saw me was probably 10 years ago. And I was doing the Tropicana in Atlantic City. And he came in and... I was nervous. I had my uncles and aunts there and everything. And I had a really good set. And we have a garage out in New Jersey. And in New Jersey, he smokes a cigar in the garage and watches his big screen TV. And his wife won't let him smoke in the house. So anyway, and he loves his garage. I get to the garage. It's 2 in the morning now after the shows and everything. I get back to the garage. He's waiting up for me. He saw the first show. And not the second. So this was his actual response. He goes, I go, did you have fun? He goes, yeah, I had a good time. He goes, you know what I don't understand? He goes, I don't see how they pay you for that nonsense you do. You make a living doing that? And I'm like, yeah, I do, actually. He said, you're a little loud and you run a lot. He goes, you're a little loud and you run around a lot. He goes, Sinatra never ran around like that. Well, if I had Sinatra's talent, I wouldn't run around either. I need to sell my stuff.
Yeah,
I can't just stand there and warble like he did.
Fly me to the moon.
I need to push my stuff out there. So I can't believe they pay you for that nonsense you do.
What does your mom think about this?
Well, she's over the moon. She loves it.
Yeah.
She thinks I'm the funniest thing in the world and keep going. And in every comic's career, you hit a point, especially if you've been doing it 20, 30 years, you hit a point where you're like, man, I'm not breaking through or I'm not doing this or I'm not doing that. And I never, ever once had the thought of quitting. Never once. But had I had that thought, my mother would have just beat me senseless. Yeah.
So you never had the thought?
Never had the thought of quitting. I had the thought of getting a second job once. But I, 15 years in and I just had kids and everything. I'm like, man, this is... But my wife stopped me. My wife, she's been my biggest supporter from day one. She said, no way, you're funny. Keep going. We'll get through this. Just keep doing what you're doing.
And she was right.
Yeah, it worked out. So I owe it to her.
I actually had the thought twice.
Really?
Yeah.
You? As funny as you are?
Yeah, thank you. That's what I mean. That's why I'm like...
Holy crap.
I appreciate that. But yeah, I was... I thought... I need to really pay my bills, and this is just not doing it. And I got out for like 6 months.
You actually did make the leap?
Yeah, I got out and did it for 6 months. I had a job for 6 months and went, no, I'm going back because I miss it. And then this was in 2000. I'd already done like all the TV shows, and I'd done Montreal Comedy Festival. And a year after that, I toured Australia with the Melbourne Comedy Festival thing. And I got offered the morning radio job right after that. And I thought, yeah, I'm tired of this. Apparently, I'm not breaking through to the other side. Yeah, I'm just going to do the radio thing. And
wow.
But I never stopped doing stand-up during the radio. I just did it on weekends or whatever. But yeah, at one point you think, maybe I'm just – it's not happening. And then I owe it to Brad, again, who talked me into really leaving radio and going back.
He did?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I was doing radio, and I was here working his show, and he goes, you know this is what you ought to be doing. He goes, you're so good at this. This is what, you know. Don't you miss this, don't you? And I go, yeah. And we were talking about I didn't like my radio partner at the time, and he put it into my head. And I went back to the radio station a few weeks later into it. I was kind of like, fire her or fire me, because I'm not doing – I just got tired of you know.
Sure.
And so I say to Brad is what put me back into comedy full time. And I'm happier about that than I've ever been. Because I even had Bruce Ayers down – he runs the Stardome in Birmingham. Bruce said – he goes, as I've known you in your entire comedy career, and I think you're better now than I've ever seen you. And I think it's partly because you get hungry again. You want to do it. You enjoy performing. You're writing again, you know.
Yeah. Well, then
do you ever feel like you have periods like that where you...
Oh, yeah. I have up and down during a show. Never mind during my career. I've questioned myself during the show. Why am I doing this? But, I guess we all owe Brad a gratitude then to have you back, because I never knew that.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm glad he talked you into that, because that would suck, because... he kills every night, and it's kind of aggravating for the rest of us, so...
But I run around and sweat a lot.
No, he doesn't, which is even more aggravating, because I have to work twice as hard to get half the laughs. It kind of sucks it.
Well, who are your comedy influences?
When I was growing up, and I'll give my age away, but I really loved Flip Wilson.
Oh,
a lot of people
too.
Don't know him. He did voices, and he was hilarious. I loved Flip Wilson.
The devil made me do it.
He had a joke about loss. He had a character named Geraldine, who was a brassy woman. And so Geraldine, the airline lost Geraldine's baggage. And I remember this line as I was a kid. She was looking at the pilot and he goes, ma'am, we can't find your luggage. She said, If you can fly this plane 3,000 miles an hour in the dark and find Los Angeles, you can find my bag. and that was in the 60s. I'm like, holy crap, this guy's crazy.
He was great.
I loved him.
They show his reruns on cable now. I've been watching them every once in a while.
I just enjoy him. It still holds up. Some of it still holds up today.
Yeah.
So I
Flip Geraldine Wilson. Was the best.
I love Geraldine.
I will knock you out. Whoa!
That was he made that. I think it was him that made the Sockatoomie Baby line famous, or maybe that was Laughing. I'm not sure. But oh, Here Come the Judge. That was his.
Here Come the Judge.
He was just cool. That was my influence, and I liked. Once I got into comedy, when I first started, I really, you'll know this. I don't know if a lot of people know this, but I really, really loved Brian Regan.
Yes.
Oh, my God. I watched Brian Regan, and he's just, he's not a household name like a, you know, a Dane Cook or somebody, but Brian Regan is just, to this day, I think he's one of the most phenomenal.
Oh, he's no Kevin Hart.
He may not be that famous, but I'll tell you what, he's as funny as you can find anywhere.
But you know what makes him funny, I think, is his... physicality and his delivery.
Yes.
Because a lot of what he says, you know, if you saw it on paper, you'd go, that's mildly amusing. But I think his whole demeanor.
Exactly.
You too. Have a nice day. You too.
Why did I say you do? How about you? Who drove you in this direction?
I was a Jonathan Winters guy.
Number one. Robin Williams and Jonathan Winters.
I loved Jonathan Winters' show when I was a kid. Did you ever see it or see?
Sure.
He'd go in the attic. Was a scene where he'd go in the attic and he would just think and improv with stuff he'd pick
so
up.
So talented.
And I was always amazed by that.
So and you knew you wanted to be a comic even when you were little?
When I was little. I've known all my life that I wanted to use humor in some way, shape, or form. Because that's like I was a cartoonist for the paper. I used to draw cartoons for the college newspaper. And
oh, wow.
I always kind of had this, the funny side. Well, I was one of those kids. I was really little and skinny, and I had buck teeth. I had really bad buck teeth, and I got braces and everything. But the humor is what you use as a defense mechanism, you know? So I was always that goofy little kid. I was always just coming up with stupid stuff, you know?
Great voice.
Yeah.
Wow, you're lucky then. I didn't know that then. I didn't know until I was older that I wanted to do it. So,
how do you know it, when it hit you? Were you watching something?
I was at that class and I came out, like I said, first place. And then the advanced class, I came out first place and I sat and I was talking to my wife and I said, man,
I'm funny.
I've gotten people to laugh all my life, but this is the first time I've ever done it in front of people on a stage. And I just, maybe I should try it. Because it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
There's no more. I mean, I imagine. I say this sometimes on cruise ships. I'm not up here, you know, doing brain surgery or heart surgery. But there's no better job on earth. You got somebody who's been they're working paycheck to paycheck. They got kids and everything's going this way and that way. And they work hard all week long, one or two jobs. And they come to a comedy club. They're kind of in a bad mood. They just want their weekend to go well. And you make that person laugh for an hour, there's no better. You bring some joy into that. There's no better feeling in the world, man. I don't care who you are, what you do. That's got to make them. Because you could sit and you can watch a singer, even the greatest singer on earth, and you get chills and goosebumps. That guy's really great. But you hear someone make you laugh and the endorphins start and your stomach hurts and your face hurts. I don't think there's any response like that in the world.
Yeah. Laughter, as Reader's Digest has always said, is the best medicine.
I totally
have
agree.
You ever had anybody tell you something like that or give you, you changed my night or my life because...
One time, and I get choked. I've had a couple of times, actually, but the one that I'll tell you is it was scary and sad at the same time, but then I felt good about it. I have two daughters. They're old now, but I used to do a routine about them, calling the clones, and I would do this whole routine about them. And half my act was my kids. And I was in a Kansas City comedy club. And I was selling my DVD afterwards and stuff. And this big guy and his wife were waiting. You can tell when somebody wants to talk to you. They're waiting in the background.
See him out of the corner of your eye.
And after the DVD sales, they finally came up to me. And he started shaking a little bit. And his wife goes, can we talk to you for a minute? And I said, sure. And he started crying. And I went, oh, my God, what is this? What am I getting myself into? She said, we just wanted to thank you. I said, "What's sure, son, what's up? She said, your talk about your daughters and everything, it just, our daughter died in a car crash like 6 months ago. She was, this is the first night we've been out since then. And I started saying, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. She was, no. She was pleased. She said, we needed this. And it brought back so many happy memories of our girl. And he was crying. I started crying. The mother was crying. All three of us sitting there blubbering, hugging each other. And all because of, you know, the situation they were in. And here I am telling jokes about my little girls. And it just, it could have gone the other way, I think. But yeah. It went, they took it in a positive note. And they were so thrilled and happy. And I still, that's 15 years ago. I still think about this today.
That's pretty amazing, really.
It really is. I had a guy one time, I do this whole thing about political correctness and how you should be inclusive of everyone, color, race, religion, all these other things, and not leave anyone out, no matter who they are. It's a long, it's part of bits I don't do here because it takes so long. Anyway, this is a true story. One of the punchlines was I was making fun of a guy in a wheelchair, and he was laughing. He had the greatest time, and it was at Fort Dodge, Iowa. At the end of the show, he came up to me, and this isn't a joke. This just gets me choked up, too. I did a whole thing about him being in a wheelchair. I was going to chop off his arm. He's going to spend the rest of his life going around in circles, shit like that. And he comes up to me and he goes, I just want to thank you. I said, what? And he said, I've been coming to this club every Friday for 4 months with the same group of guys. And every Friday we're loud. And every Friday the comic picks on us. He said, this is the first time a comic's ever picked on me. He goes, I felt like one of the guys for a change. And I said, well, you're welcome. He goes, that's not what I want to thank you for. I said, well, what do you want to thank me for? He goes, I want to thank you for this. He goes, for the first time since I've been in this chair, I've been able to forget about it for an hour. He goes, that's what I want to thank you for. Again, I got choked up. I said, geez, my God. You don't have any idea the power your words have on other people. And when you ignore someone, and this is real life too, not just comedy. When you ignore someone because they're in a wheelchair or because they're blind or they're deaf or they're different. Black or they're white or they have buck teeth like you said or whatever, you ignore someone. There was a study done in 2014 in the University of British Columbia that said to ignore a human being is more detrimental to your mental health than to be physically or verbally abused. That means it's worse for you to be ignored than it is to be picked on or made fun of. Not that I'm advocating picking and making fun of people, but yeah. Don't ignore people out there because they're a little different, especially in our line of work. If we're making fun of everybody, I try and bring everyone in.
I've said that too, because if you're an equal opportunity offender, you can't say you singled me out. Hey, you made fun of the Asian people. No, I made fun of the Alaskans, and I made fun of the Filipinos.
Who doesn't make fun of the Alaskans?
Who doesn't make fun?
But yeah, so I mean, those are two moments in my career that have touched me and stay with me today. And when I do long sets, like on, we both do cruise ships, yeah. You know, you're up there for an hour, I relay those stories to people, and
that'll probably get you the standing ovations right there. See, I haven't figured that out.
What?
That end thing. I just do my act and go.
So you just get standing ovations on your talent.
No.
I got to tell these gut-wrenching stories to get the people out of their seats.
No, that's not what I meant at all. You're a full, well-rounded entertainer. Because sure. I've seen, it's like the old guys in the inn. They would go like, you know, before I leave tonight, I would like to say, you know, like Dean Martin and those guys used to do that kind of stuff. And I've always been like, I just need to get off right this second. As soon as I quit talking, I feel like I need to dart off the stage.
I do the same thing. Those stories I tell in the middle of my set. There's nothing worse, and there's so many guys out there that do this, and I'll probably make some enemies saying this, but I don't care. There's nothing worse to me than a person, comic, singer, whatever they are, that tries to make the audience stand up. If you can't make them stand up with your talent, there's so many tricks that are out there, the turning your hands up and or telling the story about the troops or something that you're – you're begging them to stand up for crying out loud.
Yeah.
Or I've seen a lot of groups, singing groups, their last song, everybody on their feet, let's go. And they start doing a rock and roll song, and then the show ends.
And everybody's on their feet,
and then they all just start screaming. Oh, come on, everyone. I don't like that phony kind of stuff. If you're going to get a standing ovation, and I know you get them all the time, especially in the Liberty, it's because you're talented. It's not because you're out there milking the crowd and trying to get a standing ovation and you're not walking all over the stage bowing at left and right and center and everything.
Thank you.
I mean,
because I have to, seriously, I don't know what it is. I feel like I need to bolt.
I'm the same way. I finish and I get off. And sometimes on cruise ships, you know, the cruise director brings you back out a second time. And a lot of times I don't remember that. And I hear, come on. And I'm, oh, God, I got to run back out.
You've already got your coat off.
Yeah, I'm already sweating. But so, yeah. whatever you're doing great out there because you get nothing but great response, as you well know, and you've been hired back a million times. Right. So you're doing something right.
It's fun. Now, do you have anything that you're working on? I ask a lot of comics this. Do you have anything that you're working on in your head that you haven't been able to get out your mouth to the stage yet? Is like there a bit that you keep thinking, I know this, I should say this, I'm working, I have this thought?
I have a few of those. One of my downfalls is writing. I'm not a good writer. I'm not prolific in that respect. I'm more of a performer. I hate the aspect of writing jokes. If I have a joke, I won't sit down and write a 6-page joke. I'll just try it on stage. I'll just go on, I'll tell something really funny that I know is going to get a big laugh, and then I'll start telling my new thought and my new joke, and then if it does well, great. If it doesn't, I got something strong behind it. So I don't, you know, just blow the audience into the...
I'm the same way. I can't sit down at my computer or whatever and write a joke. It has to actually be organic to me. It's like an idea. And I do the same thing. I walk on stage with the idea and then go, yes! When the punchline just sort of comes out. Because I really believe your brain goes to a comedy place on stage.
I believe that's a good point.
It is. Goes to a place that you wish. I wouldn't have found that punchline just sitting here staring at my...
No way.
What would I do?
A lot of guys can do that. I can't.
No, it has to be, God, yes, that's what I wanted to say.
You know what else I like to do, I'm good at for joke writing, is I like doing it with other people. If, like, you and I are sitting here, okay, let's talk about grocery stores. Uh-huh. Somehow, you and I would come up with a good bit about grocery stores because we'd bounce, how about this, how about that?
Yeah.
Somehow, we'd come up with something funny.
Yeah.
Whereas, if I was sitting in my living room with a notebook, there's nothing funny about grocery stores. But with another person
who's back
comedically
and forth.
Inclined, I think I'd be able
to do
that.
You've seen the writing class thing where you're supposed to do, like, grocery store.
Yes.
Aisles. frozen food. Carts, and then you start trying to figure out breakdown at each one of those and how it – that doesn't work for me.
Me either. I read a really good comic told me about a book called The Artist's Way. It's supposed to teach you how to write. And it was a great book, and she's a wonderful author, but it didn't work for me. She was to get up every single morning and just write pages of stuff.
Just ideas?
Just anything that comes in your head. Hey, I'm having coffee right now, and I got to do the laundry later. Just whatever you – and it didn't work for me. But it works for a lot of other people.
Do you know people, and I do, that can sit and actually just write 50 jokes in a day? You know, like joke writers. And I just go, I don't get it. I don't understand. And they're jokes. They're
good.
They're good.
I met one comic. I was at the San Antonio, the River Center thing in San Antonio with Ron White, actually. And I was the feature, and there was an opening act who was hilarious. Anyway, they said after the second show Saturday, they're doing a midnight show, and they want he and the opener and me to do a half an hour of stuff we didn't already do. And they wanted it to be specific about this. So we're like, oh, my God, are you kidding me? We went into this back room, and it was a big Mexican themes, fiesta, that kind of a theme joke. We had to write jokes about it because the entire audience was going to be Mexican. And we went back there, and this kid, I'm struggling and panicking. I got flop sweat going.
I'd be panicking.
This kid wrote out so much stuff. His last name was Gosling. So give him credit for that.
Eddie?
It might be Eddie. Did he ever weigh like 4 or 5
pounds? Yeah, Eddie Gosling. Yeah.
He wrote like a half an hour of jokes for us, and we went up and killed. All on his talent. He wrote, say here, say this, do this, do this, do this. And he wrote all this stuff out. He literally wrote a half an hour show in 30 minutes, 20 minutes, something like that. And I was like, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen in real life as far as our business goes.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't have done that in a month. And it was funny.
Yeah, that just I feel the same way. I've seen some of those shows, like the new things, like the set list, where you don't have anything planned, but they go, here's 4 topics.
Oh, okay.
And now come back with an act. Like, I would die.
No, I couldn't do it. But that's just not our nature. That's not how we work. We perform and we come up with things on stage and we think of things in the green room and we go out and we try them. And if they fail, doesn't mean. I know a comic that had a wonderful bit, and I asked him, "Man, that's fantastic! How'd you come up with that?" He said it took 2 years of failure. He said I told that joke every night for 2 years, failing. He goes, "But I knew in my head this joke was going to work."
Yeah.
And now it's his clothes. It's
one of his clothes. Kind of what I was asking him in the question, because I know everybody's got this thing. It's like, I know it.
Yeah.
It's here. It's funny.
I don't get that committed. Because I've had jokes where I've really believed in them, and no one's ever laughed.
Uh-huh.
And I went, oh, that's it. I'm done. I can't tell the same joke three times and hope it doesn't.
Do you try it in different places? Like, okay. Because sometimes a joke will work better if you find the right place in your act for it. Like, you think it's not funny, and then one night you say it after, you go, oh, it just needs to be three quarters of the way through my act.
There you go. I've definitely had placement jokes, things that work better here than there. But there's certain things I thought were the funniest thing on earth, and I've told them in every venue on earth, and every venue I've been in, it's failed. Finally, I got to go, you know what? It's really not that funny.
But I need it because I have to kill 40 minutes clean.
Well, I came up with that line the other night, and both you and Brad looked at me like, are you serious? You think that's funny?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, it's funny. Neither one of you.
And you, Brad, was like, yeah, go ahead. You try it. And then, what you doing?
And then I told my brother-in-law and my wife, and they both went, oh, my God, you didn't say that to the other two guys in person, did you? I go, yeah, I was pretty proud of it. Neither one of them laughed.
Yeah, so, got a restraining. My knee's got a restraining order.
It's about the joke. Brad talks about getting old and
his testicles.
Your testicles dropped, and I said, "Yeah." He goes, "I need a funny line." I said, "Ah, I don't want to say my testicles are hanging low, but my knees filed a restraining order against them." I still think that's funny. No one laughed. You just shook your head. Oh well, there's a thought that.
But
won't
you know
be coming
what?
Out.
That's one of those jokes that you, if you did it on stage, would probably kill, because it's all about you, the excitement you had, the look on your face, you sold it. You know what I mean?
And you both looked at me.
What?
Like I had a turd on my lip.
Did really just try to get Brad to do a joke about a restraining order for his balls?
Oh, well, win a few, you lose a few. That's a thought that probably should have died of loneliness up here.
Oh, man. How many times will you try a joke? Like you said, three, is that the most you'll give it?
No, if I really believe something's funny, and we've all been there.
Yeah.
And I blame myself. Damn it, I didn't do that right. If I think it's my fault, I'll keep going. And a lot of times it is. 90% of the times a failure is my fault. I didn't tell it right. I was too fast. I was too slow. I too stubborn. But if I tell it five, six, seven times and at different venues and different ways, and it's not working, I'll give up on it.
Yeah.
I'm not that.
Now, I teased you the other night because you had your notes before you went on stage. And then after I teased you about it, I thought to myself, dang, that's probably pretty smart, because I have a phone, seriously, a phone full of jokes.
Really?
Bits that I want to do that I can't remember to do. And I thought, that's probably a nice little refresher right before you walk out.
It's kind of like a security blanket for me. I've been doing this since day one, and I keep it in my back pocket, and and I'm lazy, too. I get to a place like Vegas, and we all have a set amount of time to do, and my time's 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And there's so many things I want to say and bits I want to do, but I also want to get laughs, and I'm usually following Brad, so it's hard.
Yeah.
So I'll try to... I write my set list out and I get it. And if it works the first night or two, I stick with it.
That's
instead
what I'm
of,
doing
instead
for the
of
week.
Bringing is, new.
Yeah.
But if I'm eating it like a plow horse, which I've done, I change it up and bring something new in. But if it kills the first couple nights, I say, oh, I'm done. I go on autopilot with that set. And then I just start doing it. And I'll bring in a few. If something happens in the audience, I'll bring something out. But
a lot of times, the jokes that I have for mine, or they're jokes that. They're not really bits, but they're lines that I think I could use this for such and such. Like one of them, like my ex-girlfriend was a collection of crazy held together by, I can't even remember. I had to look at my phone. But anyway, it's lines like that. It's just lines that if I could remember to inject them, it would be funny. But I can't remember, because you get so used to that muscle memory of this is what I do. This is, I was supposed to do another.
I've been up there, and then it's also fun when you're up there, and there's two ends of the spectrum. You're killing, and you're like, oh, my God, I'm not going to be able to get all my jokes in, because they're laughing so hard and so feisty. Yeah. That it's eating up your time.
Right. Like, stop laughing. I got to get to my closer.
Exactly. But there's other times I've been up there and it's like, wow, I don't have enough material. No one's laughing. I got to get this out. How am I going to make this last?
Have you ever gotten to the point you thought, how am I going to close this? I mean, like, that was my closer. Boom. That's my second best closer. I have no idea what I am going to get off this stage with now.
I've done that a couple of last night's show. They were a little tough for me. So I took the first couple of nights I was doing really well. And by the time I got to my closers, I was rushing because I couldn't get them out. And I got the light and my time was running out.
Wrap it up.
So I said, I'm going to move the closer in, and I moved it, and I wasn't doing bad, but I wasn't doing great. And so I moved the closer way up and I took my time with it. And it worked, but then I went, oh, crap. It didn't get the response it got the first two nights. And then I'm like, what am I going to do now? I had this other closer lined up. And
that's what he went to. Laughing. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to tell you a story.
You guys
have been.
We need to pull together. Life is short. God bless the military. God bless America.
I'd like to say thank you for all the policemen and firemen in the world.
And if
you could stand up right now and and show your respect to. Good night, everybody.
We've all been there. Oh my God. I did a show out in Vegas for a week, and it was at the Orleans. And the guy in front of me was okay, but I had done a thing for the troops. I had just gotten back from Iraq, and that was part of my intro. So I did, I would do my show, and they said the thing about he just returned from Iraq, and people would clap. So. And I was closing this week. So the guy in front of me didn't do as well, even though he was really funny. The next night, he does his thing, and then he goes, and his time's up. Thank you very much. He goes, before I get off stage, I'd just like to share something I read today in the paper. And he pulls out this thing about a soldier who had been killed in battle. And it was a gut-wrenching, sad story. And he's reading this thing. And at the end, everybody just stood up and applauded. And I was like, that was a really nice story and a sad story and nothing but honor and respect for the person that was the subject of the story. But that had nothing to do with your act. It had nothing to do with you. You had already finished. What are you doing? And I was furious, man. I didn't know if I was just mad at myself, just mad or whatever. But he's getting a standing ovation for something that has nothing to do with his show. So I went to a comic who was working out here. Tremendous comic. I said, what would you do in that position if you were headlining? He said, I would have jacked him up against the wall. I said, this isn't part of your act. This has nothing to do with what you're doing. You're just sucking their emotions to get in a standing ovation or get off stronger than you were getting off. And so I said, all right. So it wasn't just me that thought that. And I went up to him. I said, dude, do that in the beginning. If you really feel that way about the troops, and most of us do, then you share that in the beginning and you tell the people that's what you're about.
Yeah.
Don't just throw it out there as a, ploy to get loud.
Right, because you were military.
I spent 6 years in the Marines, so it affected me more because of that experience. And just the fact that he was just using that to get applause bothered me, man. So
now that you mentioned, I had thought of this before, because I never thought to even ask somebody this before. How do you choose what branch you decided to go into? Did you say, I want to be a Marine, or do you have one of those things where they go, we offered you the Navy, we're doing the Air Force? How do you decide that's the one I want?
I was an athlete in high school, and I was fairly decent, but it was always a struggle. I wasn't a natural athlete. I remember my mom at the football stadium with the car lights on so I could jog up and down the bleachers in the dark. I really had to work hard to be as good as everyone else. So I always wanted the hardest. So the Marine Corps, I always heard, was the toughest and the hardest, mm-hmm. and I wanted to be associated with that. The Army's wonderful, the Navy, Air Force, God bless them all. But I wanted to test myself against the best. And that's why, and in my mind, the Marine Corps was the best. So that's why I went in the Marines. And I've interacted with branches, all four different branches, and they're all wonderful. Everybody's great. But it was just a little harder. The boot camp was harder and stuff. And I liked it. And it was good for me. I enjoyed it. I liked giving back to the country. I liked saying I did it. Mm-hmm. I like that it's part of my past. I couldn't have stayed in forever. too much. I would get in too much trouble.
Do you feel it changed you in any way? I mean, it made you different, or just improve you, or how do you think it? When you're different from when you came, went in, the outside. What's the?
I used to fight a lot. I got an awful lot of fights, bar fights, fist fights, all the time fighting, and it slowed that down a little bit. Because when you become stronger and better able to fight, you realize you don't have to.
Yeah.
So
I can kill you with a straw, but I'm not going
that
to.
Kind of that kind of mentality. So it matured me in that respect, and it just made me. I was already patriotic, and I already loved America, and always will, and that just reinforced that.
Well, how are you with the flag burning then?
I think they should be allowed to do it because it's America, and I know people who have died for them to do that and given that right up. And someone so much smarter than me, Antonin Scalia, who's passed away, was a Supreme Court justice. He said people should be allowed to do it. And that guy had more brains in his pinky than I have my whole body. So if he said they should be able to do it, I agree. Having said that, if I ever see anyone doing it, I'm going to get in their face. It's not going to happen. I'm going to see, that's got to stop.
Yeah.
You want to burn this, go do it where I'm not, somewhere where you don't see me.
Yeah, see, I'm totally, you may have seen my video that I did. But,
oh, yeah.
But I think it should be against the law. That's just me. And I had the argument with people about freedom of speech, and somebody said, you know, that doesn't mean just speech, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, to me, freedom of speech, and I'm still going to believe this, freedom of speech is freedom of speech. Speech and actions are two different things. I mean, I think there's laws should be written that way. Maybe if it does fall under speech, I understand that. But it's kind of like I had an argument years ago with somebody who was talking about the violent lyrics of rap music. Uh-huh. And they go, well, they have the right to do it because it's freedom of speech. And I go, no, freedom of speech is if you want to rap at a concert and you go pay for it, that's. But if you're putting out a product, that is an actual. You're putting out a product. See, I think it was written those days when people would stand on a corner and say, you know, the government is bad. Mm-hmm. You know, you see what I'm saying?
Sure, I agree.
So I think things think if it's not illegal, we need to figure out the day that's a product, that's an action, that's a, you know.
The thing that affected me about the video was the folding part.
Yes.
When you talk about folding giving a folding
and have
thing,
one given to you, you
that
know?
Struck me as like, wow, I really never really thought of it like that, but. And I've been, personally, I'm on both sides of it. I think because I know people, I'm for freedom of speech, and I think people should be able to say and do the things they want to do. That's what makes us different than everyone else, because I've been to so many horrible countries
yes.
where people can't say and do the things they want. So I always want that option there. But again, the physical sight of seeing it makes me sick.
Yeah.
And if I saw someone doing it, it would make me sick years and years and years ago. I was watching a baseball game. This is famous. And this is 30 years ago, at least. A guy runs out on the baseball field into center field in Los Angeles and starts lighting the flag on fire. And the center fielder at the time for the Dodgers was Rick Monday. That's his name. He came running in, grabbed the flag, knocked the guy to the ground, and held up the flag. And the place went berserk. They were so happy.
Yeah.
And that's over 30 years ago. It's famous. You can see it on the internet. That really impressed me. That's how I would respond if I saw someone burning the flag. I would run up and I would grab it and I would push them out of the way. I wouldn't allow it to continue if I was there, even though that's their right. I'd say, go burn it on the corner. Don't do it in front of me. So
I can see that. I mean, I understand the you know, America and the freedoms, but I think in a way, don't you think maybe we've become so uneducated and uncouth that we don't understand with great rights come great responsibilities?
Sure.
You know what I mean? I think they don't understand. They don't have the couth anymore to go, you know, that's probably not a good idea. There's other ways for us to protest.
There's so many things about the flag people don't understand. This is, to me, this is the most poignant thing I've ever seen. I was with two other comedians, Scott Kennedy, who has passed away.
Scott
was a tremendous patriot. He literally had the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, and the Marine Corps emblem tattooed on his arm. He went to Afghanistan. He went to Iraq every single month for like 5 years. He never skipped. He always brought other comics with him. I was one of them. I've gone overseas with him a couple of times. I went with this is the point about the flag, though. When I was in Afghanistan, I was with another comic named Butch Bradley, and they showed us all around the medical base. And I don't remember if it was Butch or Scott, but anyway, This is a sad story. When a soul, I believe it's Afghanistan. Please forgive me if I'm wrong. It's either that or Iraq. But when a soldier gets hurt and they get medevaced back to the, I don't remember if it was Bagram or not, when they get medevaced back to the hospital on base, when they're helicoptered in, they put on a stretcher and they're wheeled into the hospital. Right before they get in the hospital, there's a tarp. It's a curved thing. It looks like a Quonset hut. They go under that tarp. They wheel these guys through this tarp and they're on their back now. And on the ceiling of the tarp is American, the entire thing is the American flag. So these heroes, as they're coming in, maybe the last thing they ever see in their life, they're being wheeled under that American flag as they're wheeled into the hospital. And I think if more people, and that was so gut-wrenching and touching to see that, some of the guys, the last thing they're ever going to see is this flag they're wheeled under. When you see it in that context, mm-hmm. I don't think you'd ever consider burning it. I don't think you'd ever consider disrespecting it. And that's why if I see someone doing it, I'm going to physically stop them, even though I know that's their right and I would be wrong.
Yeah. And I think you and I, being from a time period where we had John Wayne and respect for America,
sure.
and we were proud of America, and I don't understand why we don't have, why being America first is a bad thing. You know, other countries put themselves first.
Sure.
You put your, but all of a sudden you're xenophobic or you're, there's some name that you, I don't understand why Americans, younger Americans don't feel, they're just not taught it anymore, I guess.
I don't think
you're
not taught.
You're supposed to be, you know, put your hand over your heart. And that's, this is my country and I will, you know, I love my people. And
well, so many people, you and I grew up saying the Pledge of Allegiance in school. So many people have fought to get that out of school. So when my daughters were going to school, they didn't say the Pledge of Allegiance yeah. every day because it wasn't allowed. Patriotism isn't taught like it used to be. It wasn't my house, but it wasn't
horrible.
Taught. Yeah, but if you look at, like, you talk about a border wall, and then you say that's a racist thing to put up a wall. Mexico has the toughest border restrictions in the world. If you sneak into Mexico
from the other side?
Yeah, from yeah. the other side, you're going to prison for 2 years. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know the exact time, but I mean, all major countries have, you know, they have to protect their state. They have to
yeah.
protect their being, their people. That's our job. Drugs pour through there. I'm not against immigration at all. I think if you legally immigrate to this country, wonderful. My grandfather came from Italy through Ellis Island and did it correctly. I mean, I'm an immigrant. My family's immigrants, so I'm for that. I just think that do it right. Get your paperwork, get in line, and become part of our country. I also think if you're going to come to America, then you should embrace our ways. You shouldn't come here and try and inflict your... If you want to do Sharia law or whatever, go to a country that has that. Don't come here and try and do it, because that's not what we believe and it's not what we represent. So I don't think people should be allowed to come here and do that, but they do.
Yeah, and I've been saying that for years. The melting pot aspect, because that's the way I grew up with. America was a melting
sure.
pot. You came from everywhere, but you became an American. You celebrate. Like, I had friends that were Cuban, escaped Cuba under the early Castro day, you know.
Wow.
But yet they didn't speak Spanish. I know that for a fact. Their parents got here, and they're like, we're in America now.
Oh, wow.
And I have a friend, Victor Franek, does not speak Spanish, and his parents are from Cuba.
Wow.
Because people came here and went, no, this is the way we do it here.
That's the way it should be everywhere.
Yeah.
Every country. I think if you're going to be a part of that country, then you adopt their ways. You represent that country. You can still, I'm not saying forget your past. I mean, I know I'm Italian and Irish and whatever, and I don't forget that. But,
yeah, you don't forget it, and you can celebrate it with really good food dishes.
There you go,
and have neighbors over to go, you've got to have the baklava.
Indeed.
You know what I mean?
But at the end of the day, my heart's hands going over my heart for America.
Right.
So,
well, man, thanks for doing the podcast.
It was so much fun.
We hit an hour, and it just goes by when you're just talking and having fun.
It is. It's a blast. Thanks for having me. I really
sure.
appreciate it.
And let everybody know how to find you, all your website, Twitter, all that stuff.
It's funnymansam.com is my website. And if you go to funnymansam.com, you'll be able to get on my Facebook and Twitter and all that other stuff there. And I'm starting on Twitter, so I haven't got a ton of followers yet, so I'm new to that. But Facebook,
go follow Sam.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the show this week. It was always fun to sit down with a comic and find out what's going on in their brain and in life and in America. So Until next time, God bless America. Go listen to some Oak Ridge Boys. I bid you adieu.
In the basement of the mud flap house, flapping and poo, and they're under with the razor nose, and poo licks herself, and flap contemplates manly things. He thinks about guns and trucks and stooges three, men and boys, and that doesn't sound right. He thinks about boobs and bacon and power tools. Come with me, let your mask you leave. Oh, won't you come with me?